Hello and welcome to The Right Idea, where we discuss the people, policy, and politics that drive Texas. I'm your host, Brian Phillips. I'm the Chief Communications Officer at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And with me, as always, is our Vice President of Research, Derek Cohen. Derek, we're back. We're doing it. We're it's the end of or middle of April now. We've got a couple months coming up. The Olympics are coming. That's a huge, you know, it's a huge event for America. It's a huge unifying event for the most part, I think, for most Americans, and get excited. I even like soccer during the Olympics, because I'll watch that and root for the Americans. Do you get in the Olympics? Are you watched it? Are you a fan?
Yeah, mostly. I kind of err more towards Winter Olympics, just because I'm a big hockey guy. But yeah, the Summer Olympics are definitely enjoyable.
Well, did you know that there are new sports this year? Mm-hmm. Well, I loosely use the word sport in this one. I want to ask you about one to see if you are interested in this. Apparently, breakdancing is now going to be an Olympic sport. Which I think a lot of people are scratching their heads as to, like, you know, is that a sport? Why is that a sport? Are we going to have ballroom dancing next? I mean, what it really opens up, you know, we're talking about athletic sports and things like that versus just sort of, I guess, movement athletic activities, not even athletic. What is your take? You think breakdancing is a sport?
Absolutely. I think you got to also look. I think you got to also look at some of the other sports that come in. You know, they added rugby sevens I think it was the last Summer Olympics. They added rugby sevens, which obviously nobody would say that's not a sport.
Yeah,
and so just kind of experimenting. I know that they're going to add esports as well, where I think that's kind of where it gets to the periphery. But
at least there's some sort of like competition. I don't know.
Have you ever seen? Well, I mean, there was a great sports documentary that came out in the '80s called "Breaking 2: Electric Boogaloo,"
I was a huge fan as an 8-year old.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Hoosiers. You know, Field of Dreams, Breaking 2. You know, it's all, again, co-equal, right, Chance? So, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, I'm looking for. I mean, you can't even keep that joke going, but, you know, it's interesting that they're experimenting things like that. And hey, if you're going to put something like that outlandish as a sport, might as well do it in France.
So,
right?
If you win the gold, do you save the gym at the end of the Olympics?
From the evil corporation that was going to,
exactly.
Yeah. I was going to make a King of the Mountain joke, but
two things I have on this. One, I think this is just the Americans. The Americans know that, like, there's not a large, you know, Chinese or Russian contingent of break dancers, perhaps, I would imagine.
So myopic.
And so this is just a way for us to steal an Olympic gold here. But more than one gold,
because I assume there's probably like doubles competitions.
There's co-ed.
Yeah, think about like the broken down box production that'll come from this, you know, and old school 80s boom boxes.
All right, moving on to more important stuff.
I will watch. As someone born in the 80s, I will watch. I will watch anything that America can win.
I will watch for about, right, exactly. As long as we're winning, that would be the really embarrassing thing, is that we actually
lose and break
the Swedish breakdancing team just overwhelmed us.
I was about to say, you know, don't sleep on Palau, you know.
The Fiji breakdancing team. All right. So shameless promotions, as I always like to do. Our newsletter, our big weekly newsletter, is called The Post. It's always got exclusive writings right at the top for me and others that contribute to it. It's kind of a compilation of all the things that we do here at TPPF and all the hot takes like these, like breakdancing that we might have that we publish throughout the week and throughout the month. It's called The Post. You can get it at texaspolicy.com/thepost. If you're not signed up for it, please do. All right. Now let's get to the reason why we're all here, which is our guest interview is with one of our TPPF lawyers. In fact, the head of our litigation center, Chance Weldon, is our senior attorney and the director of litigation for the Center for the American Future. Chance, thanks for being on with us today.
Glad to be here.
So what we want to get into is squatting, this issue of squatting. And I mean, the fact that we're even here talking about it is pretty amazing, because it's really come out. You know, there were some issues that had happened, I think, in the winter of last year, but it really over the last like 60, 90 days has become, it's kind of taken over the country, is becoming one of the issues. I want to go through some of the stories and kind of get your take on this. But it has gotten to be such an issue that now even the Senate's, the Dan Patrick, Lieutenant Governor, has added it to his interim charges. So this is one of the issues that they're going to be studying now in preparation for next session, just to make sure that Texas's laws are tight and that there's no issues with, you know, property rights issues, or that the kind of things that we'll talk about here are going to be on their way to Texas. And so it is a big issue. And I know TPPF is going to be doing some research on it and coming out with some policy proposals as well. But let me just get your first take. I mean, I think the reason why this is such an issue for people is because how could this possibly happen? How could you own property? How could you have a house that you own, or a business in this case, and some of these other stories, and people just break into the place and decide that it's now theirs, and believe, I think this is the real part that blows people's minds, is, and now believe that they would have some actual legal protection for this kind of activity. How does that happen, Chan?
Yeah, this is a perfect example of unintended consequences of laws that had nothing to do with squatting. So I think you're right. Every Texan, every American believes that if you just show up to your house and there's some random dude sitting in your living room, that you can make that trespasser leave. And if you read the laws of trespass in Texas, that's exactly how they read. But over the years, whether it be New York or some of these other states, or even in Texas, there were protections put in for renters to stop, to make it more difficult to evict people or remove people from rental properties whenever they're staying there. And it just, there's this whole process that's built in to make it more difficult and more time consuming to evict people. And what folks have realized is if they just show up to a vacant house, they can invoke the protections of these laws that were designed to protect renters and make it difficult to remove someone who just showed up at the house.
Let me just ask you about that. I mean, is there, you know, could you defend that? I mean, is there a legitimate case where you have, I don't know, some slum landlord or something like that that's basically trying to kick people out and doing it in some nefarious way? I mean, are there legitimate reasons for these, at least these original laws that would protect renters?
I mean, I think you'd have to go on a law by law basis, but I think that's where the core of it started, was this idea that there needs to be some process to make sure that when people are being evicted from a tenancy or their lease is getting canceled, that there be some sort of due process protection for those families that are in those homes. And look, it's a classic example of public choice theory, right? You have voters, people that rent vote. You know, there's a huge, particularly in urban areas, a huge portion of the population that vote for local laws. They're renters. They're going to want these sort of procedural protections to stop them from being evicted. But over time, what you see is, like so many things, and Derek can, of course, attest to this, who works with the Ledge, it's not like ordinances and laws are written with the utmost precision and care.
Huge if true.
Yeah, huge if true. And as a result, it creates these situations where there are incentives now for people to just sit down in someone's house.
And I do, Derek, I want to get to whether or not you think, and in your initial research, you think Texas's laws are tight enough for this. But the one of the big stories that kind of took the country's, or kind of capture the country's imagination, and this is an interesting legal theory on the part of the squatter, is that a couple bought a, I think it was $2 million home, and only to find that someone who claims that the previous owner, who then died, said he could stay there in the house. So the owner, you know, the current, the previous owner has this person in there, says you can come, says you can stay, but then that person dies, and of course the estate, for whatever reason, they sell the house. Now the couple shows up and they've got this squatter. Do you think, I mean, is that a different kind of legal issue? Is that a different kind of, or a tougher kind of way? Because now they're actually claiming, yes, you know, I've got some legal claim to this because the previous owner allowed me to stay here.
No, so that brings up a very good point. So that's what's known specifically in property law as a lie. And so,
is it a technical term?
Chance, we don't want to go back to the 1L, 2L discussion.
That's a lot of legalese. Yeah, exactly. Right? I don't know. Let's tone it down for the people.
But all joking aside, that holds absolutely no water, because the conveyance of ownership of the property is with the documentation theretofore. It's also why we pay, you know, these ridiculous title insurance. Mandated title insurance payments, because that is actually a point of, you know, the hygiene necessary to transfer the deed. And so one of the things that you've seen and that you mentioned is when there is a claim that, you know, somehow justifies the adverse possession, right? And so that just does not hold water at all for me, because again, that individual has nothing but the word of someone who is deceased giving them the most credit possible to back up their claim. And even if, let's even say that did happen, that does not actually affect the ownership interest through the traditional channels.
Chance, one of the ones, the other big story that kind of made this explode, because now we've got some celebrity involved, is of course celebrity chef Gordon Ramsay. He's got a hotel/restaurant that he has over in London that they haven't done anything with. And so people just decided, it's in a really ritzy part of town, and he's either trying to sell it or renovate it or whatever. He's trying to do something with the property. a half a dozen folks just decided, well, if you're not going to do anything with it, then we are. And so not only did they break and enter and they've been living in it or whatever, now they've actually turned it into some sort of community art center and are like selling coffee out, you know, or I guess they're giving coffee away or whatever.
Selling coffee is a little too capitalistic, right?
Right. So they're just giving it away. But they're, you know, they're basically saying, well, you're not using it. So we've now just decided that this is going to be our space. And they're posting, you know, pronouncements that, you know, if you come in here, you'll be violating our rights. Or if you try to kick us out, that the law is on our side. I mean, this is crazy.
Yeah. So that's in England?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
not that you're steeped in the English law necessarily.
No, I just feel like the folks in 1776 in America would not be surprised that the English protections for property rights are not as good as you would prefer. But
there's a whole Third Amendment about it.
Yeah. Well, so instead of throwing away the tea, they're just handing it out for free.
Yes. Yeah. So I think that's a real problem. You know, you don't get to just walk into someone's property and say, I think I could use it better. Mm-hmm. The word for that, like you said earlier, the very complex legal word for that is theft, right? Like if I just take your stuff because I think I could use it better, mm-hmm. that's theft. And again, this is taking advantage of procedures that weren't designed to deal mm-hmm. with this, but have created a legal bureaucracy that makes it very difficult to get thieves and trespassers out of private
property. And this is where they sort of expose themselves as really being Marxist and communist, right? Because their justification is that this is better for the community or that we have decided, we have taken upon ourselves to make use of this, and therefore because it's better for the community, therefore they should be allowed to stay there and have it.
Look, the whole purpose of having private property is someone else doesn't get to decide what would be better for the community with my private property. That's, I'm sure that there are a great many things that someone else might want to do with my home, mm-hmm. right? But the fact that it's mine means that I get to make those
decisions.
Not
to get off track here, but you do a lot of cases like that and defending private property owners here in Texas when even in certain instances, I know like the Schlitterbahn-Nebronfels case about people saying, well, we would like you to do something else with your property because we're in the community and we don't like what you're doing with it.
Yeah, that's a big part of our litigation, whether it be like protecting short-term rental owners and then the people in the community decide, well, we don't want short-term rentals. We think it would be better as a long-term rental, or we think it would be better if someone else owned it, or, you know, you know, or the monies down in San Marcos who wanted to remove an initial from the front of their home and the mm-hmm. city said, well, we think it looks better, so you have to keep the initial up. And we represent property owners in those sorts of cases all the time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One issue I want to get into, maybe get both your remarks on this, is its connection to housing affordability. This is obviously something that is a huge issue. We did some polling recently and over 70% of Texans believe that housing affordability is already into a crisis. Yep. Mm-hmm. What's the connection? Is there a connection chance there between, you know, the root of this being that housing isn't affordable, and so not that that gives you the right to go in and break into someone's unused property, but maybe it's a derivative of that.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. The reason that we have this problem, I think, in large part, is because we do have a housing affordability crisis. And the reason we have a housing affordability crisis is because local governments, through their zoning laws, have made it illegal to build housing. Mm-hmm. It is illegal and prohibitively expensive to build affordable housing. And if you want housing to be affordable, you have to stop making it illegal. And mm-hmm. so this government-created problem has forced people in some situations to create creative ways to find places to live. And the solution, of course, is in both cases property rights.
All right, Derek, are you shocked to hear that government is at the root? Bad government policy is at the root of some of this.
I don't know. I was just talking to James Quintero earlier, and he said the government's just doing an absolutely great job, and if anything, we're paying superintendents too little. but no, you know, before y'all got here, I was talking to Jefferson. You know, just sitting around talking about what most guys talk about, the film adaptation of Les Mis.
I came in on the wrong part of that conversation.
Well, no, and I bring that up because I think that what is implicit, what Chance hit on, and then the justification that we see from some of the more sympathetic local and state-level elected officials is that these are all these Jean Valjean types who are stealing a loaf of bread to you know, feed their family when it's not. Mm-hmm. You know, it's these are crimes of opportunity, mm-hmm. and sometimes crimes of opportunity being undertaken by folks with the means to not have to do that. Completely agree with Chance's diagnosis that this is a self-inflicted wound by local governments. And not only that, I'll yes and that by saying that the affordability crisis is then deepened by their reckless spending, wherein, you know, they just, you know, keep raising tax rates and raising tax rates. You know, we go back to the old example that we read in The Statesman, where, you know, that one individual was complaining. She's like, I don't understand why I'm getting taxed out of my home. I voted for every bond to make this a good community. And it's like, I don't know what you tell
you
these
people.
You
just answered your own question.
Yeah.
And not to get conspiratorial there, but you mentioned, you know, these aren't the Jean Valjean types, you know, they're, but it does feel like there is a coordinated effort here that, I mean, especially with the Gordon Ramsay thing, it feels, you know, these aren't just people who are like, hey, there's a door I can break into and let's go, you know, start serving the community coffee. It feels a little more coordinated than that. It feels almost, I wouldn't say sophisticated, but the fact that you have people calling themselves professional squatters, Derek, do you see any evidence of coordination, or has this been always kind of under the radar, and now that you've got a Gordon Ramsay or someone that's being affected by it, now it's kind of popping up?
Are these professional squatters like part of the union? I mean, are they, you know, like, I mean,
the squatters
they're still on the rookie contracts,
the squatters union? Yeah, but that's when they truly eat themselves, is when they, you know, you have these communist, you know, Marxist organizations, and now we unionize.
Yeah, so, well, we can talk about that later. But no, I honestly have not seen enough to suggest that it would be coordinated. But like I said, whenever you have a crime of opportunity like that, there are always opportunists. Mm-hmm. And I think that the only reason we know of the Gordon Ramsay one, obviously, is because of the celebrity of it. What you're not hearing about is, you know, somebody's house in the suburbs in Dallas or Fort Worth or something like that, because it just doesn't rise to the level of public consciousness. But the point is, and to emphasize what Chance has said, is that we basically have created the entire Western system of government on the preface that a free citizen can own property. Mm-hmm. And that is and that's why I think there's this visceral reaction against this kind of wave, whether it's organic or non-organic, of this wave of squatting, simply because it is so anathema to the way we order our society that if somebody can divest you of a property interest simply by existing in a particular space, then what are we even doing this for?
Right. Yeah. I mean, if anyone's just bought a house, I mean, you have that, you know, a closing, very 2-3 hour process sometimes of all of the things that go into the transfer of that little quarter lot or whatever it is that you bought into your possession. All the things you have to sign, all the things you have to declare, and then what the community is actually allowed to do. So in terms of the utilities and things like that, about them being able to get on your property, it's very clear who owns the property.
So to make a point on the question that you asked, Derek, I think this is a perfect example of two alternative views about how to deal and what the cause and what the solution is to housing affordability. Mm-hmm. There's one view that's always been on the left, that the reason that people don't have housing is some rich fat cat is hoarding stuff and someone needs to take their property. Mm-hmm. And that's what squatting looks like. It is a physical manifestation of that ideology. On the other side, there's been for years the idea that the reason that we have an affordability crisis is the government's not letting people do what they want with their property. They're not letting people build. And if you want housing to get cheaper, you got to just build more of it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so you have in the squatting scenario, what's literally a physical manifestation of those two competing views of philosophy. One that says we should steal other people's stuff, and one that says we should let people use their property. And I think the moral side of that argument is the one that doesn't involve, you know, stealing people's stuff.
Want to get into the Texas response to the squatting, and in true Texas tradition of a state that's, you know, national state motto is, well, it's not the official state motto, but we're the come and take it state, of course. You know, there's a lot of bravado and a lot of, you know, chest puffing, I guess, out there saying, you know, it's not going to happen here, it's not going to happen in Texas, and we have very strong property rights laws, which we'll get into in a second. But Abbott did tweet the the governor did tweet, in Texas, anyone squatting in your home is breaking the law. They are criminals violating Texas laws like criminal trespass and criminal mischief. Also, the Texas Castle Doctrine empowers Texans to use force to defend themselves and their property. So he's basically saying our laws protect property yeah. rights owners. Anybody, you know, don't bring that mess in here. Mm-hmm. I do want to get into what he did. He refers to the Texas Castle Doctrine that empowers Texans to use force to defend themselves and their property. There were some articles about this after Abbott had tweeted, and there were certain lawyers who suggested that that might not be as airtight as we think. And then, in fact, you still need to have a credible threat before you can use force to defend yourself. Chance, you say that's not the case.
So two big disclaimers. First, as any lawyer will tell you, it depends. And second, I'm not giving anyone criminal legal advice, okay, right? This is not criminal legal advice. But I think this is a good example.
Okay, what would you do if you found a squatter in your house?
I think that's – so the
you'd be looking for criminal legal advice.
Yeah. The Texas Castle Doctrine, if I just came home and there was strange people in my home, right, certainly I don't have to wait for them to attack me to try and remove them from my home.
To physically remove them
from my home. There's a strange person in my home. And this goes back all the way to John Locke, right? If someone's in my home, I don't have to, the presumption is that they mean to do me harm. And I don't have to guess about that. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, any sort of advice on that abstract theory, you know, the rubber's going to meet the road somewhere, and somebody can get charged with assault, and somebody can get charged with murder. And the question is, do you want to have that abstract legal theory as your protection against a criminal charge when you physically remove someone from their home? And that is where the problem comes up.
Well, also on those articles that you're mentioning, I don't know where they found some of these law professors, because what you said really makes sense in terms of actually, you know, parsing out the nuance of the application of the Castle Doctrine. But one of these law professors just went and said, like, oh, well, no, you have an affirmative duty to retreat. And it's like, that is explicitly what the Castle Doctrine does away with,
right.
To that point. And so I
retreat from your own house while someone is
well, there are some states where that is true.
Yeah.
Where that is the case.
Sure. Not Texas.
Yeah.
Not Texas.
These are also states where you're probably not going to be shooting them anyway because you can't have guns, like cough New York. Things like that.
Can you write a sternly worded letter to the squatter?
Yeah. like a Wes Anderson communique, you know?
Yeah, exactly. From outside your window, please leave.
Yeah. I'm getting really serious. Get out of my house.
But there's a difference. There's a difference. And I think this is some of the point that they were making. There's a difference between I open up my door and there's a strange person in my house, and I have someone who overstays their lease, and therefore I just show up and try and drag them out. Right. Those are very different things. And right. I think that's what the law professor, to steel man their argument, I think that's what they're making.
I think you're being very generous, steel manning a law professor's argument.
That's what I'm known for, Chance Weldon, generosity.
we're going to have to cut that out, Jeff. But I think that kind of pivots to the policy discussion that's going to need to happen. And to be honest with you, and I definitely applaud Governor Abbott's,
his tweet.
Resolve on, as manifest by his tweet, but his resolve on the issue. And I also got to say, I think Governor DeSantis handled it pretty well, too, with what they put through in Florida, which basically just said, you know, you can go basically have an ex parte hearing. And if you can produce evidence before a judge, like the minute that gavel comes down, the sheriff's going to your house to remove those people. Yeah. But also within that law, there also is an off ramp for individuals that might be subject to, like, if it was ever up for a lease and that's something that needs to be adjudicated, there's that particular exception that exists.
So to Texas policy, the Senate's interim charges just came out. Essentially, that's just the list of research projects that the leaders of the House and the Senate give to the various committees of jurisdiction to say, hey, here's some things that we need to research. We need to look at how previous laws that were passed, are they being implemented correctly? And then new issues like this that come up, it gives kind of a blueprint of what the legislative session is going to look like. I was surprised that they had, that they were able to put this squatting issue on there. It says, secure Texas against squatters, review current laws relating to squatters or those claiming adverse possession of property, make recommendations to streamline the process for the immediate removal of squatters and to strengthen the rights of property owners. What does that tell you, Derek?
tells me there's going to be a law that's going to expedite the removal of squatters and strengthen the rights of property owners. Probably, probably going to be passing in late March.
Right, exactly. Right, basically the first week of of regular session. So, but does this mean? I mean, I guess the way talk about the rubber meets the road.
Yeah.
Does this mean? Hopefully, I think this means, and the way that this should work is, if someone's trying to squat on your property, you call the authorities, and the authorities know that their job is to go and remove the squatters off of your property, and that's it. And if they resist or they're whatever, you take necessary action, and they need to be jailed or whatever. But the point is, the law is on your side. Law enforcement is going to be there to support you, and they're going to remove the squatters.
I think the one problem, though, with that assessment, though, I think the first half's absolutely correct. And the fact that law enforcement will, I mean, again, there's going to be, it has to be a modicum of due process. You're going to have to somehow demonstrate that you have an ownership interest in that property, and that probably also demonstrate as well that it's not a rental property or whatever the case may be. And then I think once that box is checked, the individual's room, now the subsequent part's the deterrent part, right? You know, is there should also be, I think it's currently at the lowest level, a Class B misdemeanor for trespass. The places where this is going to be the biggest problem are not the places that are going to start prosecuting for trespass. They're places that are letting far worse things go right now, such as Travis County. And so I don't think there's really going to be there's going to be a process, but there's not going to be necessarily be justice for it.
So you mentioned Travis County, who just announced that that the mutilation of minors for transition treatments or whatever is going to be a low priority for them to prosecute. I can't imagine, Chance, that squatters is going to be that high on the list in Travis County.
Yeah, unfortunately, property rights historically have been the redheaded stepchild of the rights to get protection through the judicial system. And the wheels of justice often move far, far more slowly than we would like. And that's really the problem, is that you have a lot of places, you already have processes to get people out of homes that are squatting. But if it takes 6 months or 8 months or 18 months to actually work through those processes, then what really is the point? And so the trick is going to be getting a policy that has some real teeth and a real enforcement mechanism to actually force it through a judicial system that isn't always willing to move quickly when it comes to property
rights. And the scenario go ahead.
I was going to say, you would like to see that, like, you know, especially with the categorical declarations of office, much like the one you mentioned about the trans issue. You know, you'd like to hope that HB 17, you know, erased a lot of that. But again, to Chance's point, is that you still have this litany of process that comes afterwards. Here, in this particular case, it's called hold the district attorney accountable, that you're probably just not going to see it. Now, the good thing is about that particular law is it's not incumbent upon local prosecutors to enforce that law. That is solely a law. And of course, you know, this, if you listen to what the activists say, they say that, oh, this is basically the jackbooted thugs will show up and throw them in prison. But what that law does is it simply penalizes the medical practitioners within the state. You know, it has nothing to do with, you know, parents or anything like that. So I think that's just that particular instance is just grandstanding on.
And it is two different issues in terms of prosecutorial discretion versus what the cops do when you call them.
Yeah.
And I think for most people, if it takes 18 months to get to put this guy through the system because he trespassed on my property, you know, that's, I mean, maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't. I don't know. What I really need is for when I show up and he's there, I need the cops to show up and get him out of
my house. That was the point that I was making. If the process to get someone removed is 18 months or 20, you know, like, and that's what you see a lot in a lot of these property cases, even on the civil side, to get something that moves, well, then what's the point?
Right. Yeah. So you have the issue of the prosecutor in Travis County who may not necessarily prosecute the case, but what are there things that they can do in the law that'll, you know, tighten up and make sure that the, you know, local law enforcement knows that that's the rule, is that they need to show up and that they need to, I mean, is there anything at is there any kind of tension between local law enforcement and what the state could legislate that would allow the cops to show up and say, well, we don't really know what we're supposed to do because our prosecutor is telling us one thing, but the law says the other thing.
Well, I think that you just have to look at the incentives for or the incentives on law enforcement's behalf, you know, because everyone tries to, we can't paint prosecutors with a, you know, a monolithic brush, because obviously the prosecutor in Lubbock County and the prosecutor in Travis County probably fairly radically different in their approaches to enforcing the law. Law enforcement's largely, since it's a composite entity, is largely even in liberal jurisdictions, fairly moderate to even center right. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there would be much more of a an eye towards this. Now, I mean, we can talk about other issues of property rights vis-a-vis law enforcement, civilized forfeiture, we discussed a million times, you know, where that might not be the case. But even so, I think that with something like this, something that could just as easily happen to one of their friends or family members, mm-hmm. I think you're going to see a lot more enforcement or willingness to enforce, I should say, on the law enforcement side.
Chance, we are really, really appreciate you coming in and talking to us about this issue, and we will keep an eye on this. Obviously, the interim charges will come out. There'll be some research and reports, and so we'll come back and revisit this issue when all that comes out. We have about 10 minutes left, and we like to do something fun at the end of the show to kind of leave on a high note, because a lot of times it's a lot of doom and gloom here about things. And so,
you mean anyway, squatting is not a high note?
Yeah, well especially because there's no resolution, because we don't really know. You know, we're waiting for the laws to come out. But if you'll stick with us, we'll mm-hmm. go through a couple of different segments. One is new segment. I want to. We talk about polling a lot on the show, so we just figured, hey, let's just have a segment about it, because it's something that I like. I think, you know, a lot of political insiders love, you know, the catnip of polls and things like that. And this one's actually kind of related too. But all right, so survey says Emerson College poll came out. It was a little bit shocking and maybe have some political ramifications for the election this year. 75% of voters think that the cost of living in the United States is rising. Just 18% think that it's staying the same, and only 7%. Think that the cost of living is easing. Derek, I think this is a huge number. I mean, I think there's a massive...
7% margin of error, yeah.
Yeah. 75%, yeah, right, 7% think it's easing. 75% of voters think that cost of living in the United States, that is a huge barometer. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times in polling, we look at, you know, what people say about the economy. It's not really that they're saying, Chance, that the economy's bad because they look at GDP numbers or whatever. Yeah. Or whatever. It's really just sort of a general feeling about the direction of the country. And so, Derek, your thoughts on 75%. Do you think this is a huge harbinger for the rest of the year?
Well, I mean, I think if you just look at, you know, the polling, and not just, you know, recent polling, you know, where the actual pinch from the inflation's happened, but, you know, from the last, say, 2 years, you know, the economy has been such a millstone around President Biden's neck, and rightfully so, because many of the policies have exacerbated. I'm not one of these ones that the president fully dictates economic behavior and inflation, stuff like that. Not saying that at all. They definitely can make it worse, and I think that there's an argument that that's what we've actually seen. What I think this is more reflective of, because this is where you get the, you know, Paul Krugmans of the world trying to throw people off the scent, saying, oh, yeah, you know, this is just, you know, greedy corporations, you know, your Snickers bar is getting smaller, things like that. No, this is like, this is something where people are going to believe their lying eyes on this particular thing, because they're not going to be rationed away that things are getting, or rationalized away that things are actually getting cheaper. And that one of the issues that I think that the independent confirmation that I think you see on this is, well, they remember the time that inflation, instead of roaring, just kind of simmered down a little bit and still above average, but you know, is when they started, oh, this is the success of Bidenomics. They've since abandoned that, because I'm talking about a toxic brand.
Well, remember when they said that hot dogs went down 11 cents and then everybody should be, you know, excited about that?
It was exactly the same. I can't remember if it was, I think it was right at towards the beginning of the Biden administration, where as Council of Economic Advisors, somebody tweeted out a graph of gas prices going down. That was literally a 2-month observation. It was there and there. And it's,
and then when you widen it
out, zoom out, and it's like, oh, this is the other side of the peak of the Matterhorn. Okay.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about, Chance. I mean, the White House is sending out everybody they can to try and convince people that, again, they're lying eyes.
Yeah.
All these graphs and charts, and look at all these numbers and whatever, and yet we all go to the grocery store and we spend 3 times as much as we did 3 years ago.
So you said it was 18%.
Said it's staying the same.
Staying the same.
Only 7% think the cost is easing.
So 18% either don't buy their groceries or can't do basic math.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's right. Everything's more expensive than it was. If you go and get a gallon of milk, it's more expensive. You get hamburger, it's more expensive. If you buy gas, it's more expensive. I mean, I had to drive in this morning and buy gas, and it's not cheap. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, my wife and I will try to have like a random date night or whatever and go out and go out to eat or whatever. And now we have to really think about where we're going. Because, I mean, it could be the difference between, you know, $70 or $80 and almost $200 at some places. It's insane what it costs to just go out and try and, you know, have a meal, you know, outside the house.
So Taco Cabana is going from every month to every other month, is what I'm hearing.
You know, I'm a romantic at heart.
Taco Cabana is a solid date. I don't know what you're talking
about. As long as you can't follow Krugman's advice, but, oh, just go to Taco Bell, and it's just not the same. But I think that aside from the branding thing, one of the things to remember is, and I tell folks on the right this all the time, is that they think that, again, much like the errant perception that one election caused all this trouble, mm-hmm. is that the one election will fix all this trouble. And the thing you got to remember about inflation is it's not like, let's say that we hit the magic reset button and go back to 2017 or whenever it was. Where prices are now, there might be a slow letting air out of the balloon. They're not going back, though. Mm-hmm. You know, the days that a value meal at McDonald's was, you know, $7 or whatever, those days are gone.
Yeah.
Those will never come back. And the thing is, and what I think the real errancy on the part of the Biden administration.
Old days.
Yeah, Freudian slip there, my bad. is that, you know, the errancy on there is that they're bragging about a slowing, a backing off of the throttle on inflation, mm-hmm. saying it's still rising a lot faster than it has, or even that even the Fed would want, but they're doing so in a way, spiking the football on the, yeah, but it's not as bad as it was.
Right.
And it's like, yes, but it's still much, much worse than it was, depending on where you put that frame.
All right, shifting topics into another new segment that we have that's called Lies, Damn Lies, and Statistics. Yes. We look at some research that maybe TPPF or others, some of our coalition partners are doing. You mentioned this earlier, bringing up James Quintero and the superintendents. Chance, would it shock you to find out that there are 91 Texas superintendents in the state that make $300,000 or more?
Well, you know I work at TPPF, right?
Like, no, so it's just
never
came up.
Government bureaucrats making a lot of money. That sounds about right. $300,000.
There's nearly 100 superintendents. And granted, we have a lot of school districts. We have like 1,200 school districts or more, mm-hmm. or whatever it is. But still, that seems like a lot. I mean, then you go down and look at those just making $200,000 or more, which again, these numbers put all of these folks in the 1%.
That is a staggering amount of money for a government bureaucrat.
Yeah, that is a ton. And then to make matters worse, I mean, that stat alone is just sort of like mind-boggling. But that brings up a couple of issues. One is, you know, you have the left saying, well, we need more money. That's why, you know, we're underfunded and all this kind of stuff. Well, when you have that level of bureaucracy of people making hundreds of thousands of dollars, and I mean, and what is everybody underneath of them making? It's not like they're making $400,000 or $500,000 and then the next guy's making 50, although that is the teachers. The teachers are the ones making the $30,000 and $40,000, but all the bureaucracy that goes along with that.
Well, also it's getting paid that much when no one's happy with the product that you're producing.
Right.
Like in the private market, you would not be getting raises when the product you're producing sucks.
Yeah, so let's get into that because, again, this is the research portion. We're not just going to throw out these things. So I looked at the top 10 highest paid superintendents and looked at their school districts. Derek, in Isleta district, they're the third highest. They have the third highest paid superintendent. They're only the children there are only 44% can do math at grade level.
How many of the administrators can?
Yeah, only 51% can read at grade level. Here's stunning. The fifth highest paid superintendent at Garland ISD, only 38% of the kids in that district can do math at grade level. You go down to the 10th highest paid superintendent in Duncanville, only 27%. This person makes $392,000 a year, and only 27% of their kids can do math at grade level. And reading is only at 41%. So to Chance's point, we're paying all this money for what?
Well, first of all, I think that's some great digging. And, you know, we might have a spot for you on the policy team if this comms thing doesn't work out.
That's that's the extent of my research right there. That's all.
it was good. It was definitely good while it lasted. But, you know, so that Chance's point is exactly spot on, is that people are not satisfied with the price. There are definitely some people that are, you know, I would say, just given, you know, the four digits count of school districts that we have. I guarantee that we do have a school superintendent out there that's making an awful lot of money, and the vast majority of the people are very satisfied with it, and mm-hmm. the kids are achieving. I guarantee that exists somewhere.
I'll give you one. Cypress Fairbanks, they're the number one. Their guy makes $536,000, and yet you've got, but the numbers
are
better.
It's also a really big district, too.
It's a huge district, right, and it's outside of here. A lot of the Harris County ones make sense in terms of just because of the sheer
size
volume
and density, yes.
But at least you've got 70-some percent that are reading at grade level. You've got 60-some percent that are in the high 60s that are doing math at grade level. These are 20 and 30 points higher than some of these guys who are just underneath of it.
Look up on your list there, Barbers Hill. I remember the jump.
Yeah, Barbers Hill is second, and he's making $477,000.
With what enrollment?
The enrollment has just 7,700 kids. And he's making now the grades are good. The grades are in decent shape. Mm-hmm. But yeah, $477,000 and there's 7,700 kids versus Cypress Fairbanks, which has 118,000 kids.
Do we know what teacher salaries are in those districts?
We can definitely. But we'll get to that on the next show.
Yeah, because I think that matters. I mean, what do you think is more important to a kid reading at grade level? Having a good teacher mm-hmm. or, you know, the guy who sits in the cubicle and tells everybody when to show up.
And these are the people who come before and testify come before the committees and testify that, and they're mad at the legislature for not, you know, earmarking teacher salaries in the budget, and yet they go home to their $577,000 job.
It's absolutely ridiculous. I made this point on a panel on Wednesday, is that we have decided, and again, this is structuring of Texas, we've decided back in the 1800s, that we are going to fund local institutions locally, obviously through the property tax, and which we discussed many other times. But that's the thing. And so we give local control to these entities, and they decide to put up bonds that they don't need for in auditoriums and stadiums. They decide to pay these lavish salaries for, you know, to your point, if that guy's making $500,000, what's the director of cardboard pizza procurement making at the district office?
Right.
We do all that, and then they have the temerity to come rattle the tin cup at the legislature?
Yeah.
Or complain about property taxes that they are the ones setting the rate
for?
Why
are these property taxes so high? What to pay your freaking salary?
It's that meme with the hot dog guy going, we're all trying to figure out who did this.
La Jolla District, a couple years ago, there was a big controversy because I'm not sure if that one was the Golden Parachute one where they left and ended up $700,000.
La Jolla was Golden Parachute, water park, and golf course.
Water park and golf course, so spending all that money. There's another one where we found out that someone was getting not only $1,000 a month housing stipend, but also $1,000 a month car stipend.
Wow.
Like, you know, I mean, I have a pretty nice car, but it's nowhere near like $1,000 a month. Like, what are you getting for your car for $1,000? She's driving around a Mercedes or some Maybach or something, you know? But again, these massive salaries. And again, at La Jolla, you've got only 41% can do math at grade level, only 41% can do reading at grade level. And so this is the kind of thing that frustrates people that, you know, especially those of us who are working on these policies and hearing from the left constantly that the districts don't have any money, and then these kind of statistics
and
come out.
Pretending that, look, public service is supposed to be to a certain extent a sacrifice. You realize when you go out of the private sector into the public sector that you're supposed to be giving something up, like, you know, $500,000 salaries.
Mm.
And so to come in and have the sanctimony to come in and pretend that you're this public servant that's sacrificing, and therefore you need to be treated with the respect that comes along with that sort of virtue, when at the same time you have $1,000 car stipend.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're running out of time here. I want to get to the last news segment that we have. What are you watching, Derek? What's coming up in the next couple of weeks that you want folks to know about?
Well, I know what you're going to say, but I have to say that parallel to that, one of the big things, and I think that'll be really important to see.
Well, do you want me to do mine first then?
Okay, I'll do yours first.
Okay, I'll do mine. The one thing I'm watching, one thing I'm very excited about is, of course, we passed, it was SB 17, was the anti-DEI programs at public universities, which has been implemented, and there's been some controversy over whether or not they're actually being implemented. Well, Senator Brandon Creighton, who oversees that committee in the Senate, is calling in some of the heads of the universities to have them detail what they've done over the last 4 months to actually start to implement those policies, and that really is where you have the holding, you know, these universities accountable for. They're going to have hearings at the early part of May, and so obviously we'll be covering that, and we'll be interested in what they have to say there, and whether or not they can actually say yes, we're following the law, or if there's going to be some fireworks.
Yeah, and allow me to yes end that, because that I think is probably the number one thing that most people that pay attention to in this world are waiting for. One of the things, and we talked about this on the show with Mr. Bonson, this DEI thing is just so pernicious. And then you've seen, you know, the rending of garments and gnashing of teeth when these, you know, 61, you know, the numbers vary, administrators have gotten laid off by UT. Everyone's up in arms, like, can you believe they laid off 61? I'm like, I can't believe that they had that there were 61 people whose job descriptions were so on the nose and flagrant violation of the law that even the administration laid them off. That's what I find surprising. But to say, I wouldn't want to say second fiddle, because it's definitely a very key importance, is similarly, there's going to be water hearings in the Senate. And I think that, you know, some of the direction that we see that policy discussion going is going to have serious implications for the state. I think that the Senate, I believe that's chaired, if I recall correctly, by Senator Perry. Obviously from the Lubbock area, obviously knows well of the scarcity of water, specifically up in the Panhandle. But I think that there's going to be a really good discussion on that. We're going to start seeing, what does a Texas water plan, I'm not just talking about creating an account for it, what does an actual Texas water plan look like? And I think that's going to have impact for the better the lives of many Texans.
Good stuff. Chance, anything on your plate the next couple of weeks that you're watching, or any cases that you're
breakdancing?
Definitely the breakdancing.
Not till August.
Also, they've added surfing to the Olympics as well, so I'll be watching that.
Isn't that going on in Polynesia or something?
Yeah, and I always watch the boxing. No, but what we're watching right now is we're waiting to see if the Texas Supreme Court is going to take our ETJ case.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who are familiar, we've argued that cities regulating outside of their borders and regulating what you can do with your property when you don't live in the city and don't receive any services and can't vote. We think that sort of regulation without representation is unconstitutional. And so we're waiting to see if the Texas Supreme Court's going to take it this summer.
That's good radio right there. We come full circle back to property taxes, right where we started. Chance, again, we really appreciate you taking time to come down and talk to us about this issue that's kind of exploding all over the country. So hopefully people got some new information and know that Texas is working on it, and hopefully we'll get it right. So for those of you watching and listening, we really appreciate it. Of course, you can, if you have any topics for the show or you have any feedback for us, you can always find us online at Twitter or X or whatever it's now. So we really appreciate your feedback on that. Even the haters, we love you guys coming out and letting us know that you liked or didn't like whatever it is that you heard or saw. So we really appreciate you listening and watching. And as always, in the words of Sam Houston, do good and risk the consequences. We'll see you next time.